I have a question for both their excellencies. And my question is, how would you characterize a global community, and how should we build towards it?
I tend to have a view that if everybody creates their own little community, that there will be values, and values like tolerance, decency, I mean, we can compassion, we can make a whole list of them. If you make a decent community, then you will link, it's like chemistry, which I was hideously bad at, but I know the drawings anyway, little things all linked together, that's how you make a global community. I don't think you start from the top down and say, we're going to do this. I think the United Nations is a terrific forum, and I think it's a very important thing to be part of the United Nations so that you share with other people. It's very important from the point of view of world peace, for instance. And because it means that we work in different directions with different countries. But I think that in order for the ordinary individual to help with being the world, that you start with your community, and that builds out. Sometimes it's because the organization actually is part of a larger thing, like Oxfam or Amnesty. That's where you will develop those muscles to understand what makes human society actually operate is in community. And as John said, it's really not about the fact that you can just make yourself an individual and then hope that the rest will follow. That is not going to be. There's a Desmond Tutu, who is the wonderful Archbishop Tutu of South Africa, who got the Truth and Reconciliation Commission going after the end of apartheid, explained so wonderfully about their concept of Ubuntu. And Ubuntu means, I'm a human being because I am part of you, and I would not be a human being without you. Human beings need each other. And I think if you take that as a fundamental value, then you build out from there.
The Western philosophical view of that is that civilization or being a human being is your ability to imagine the other. But you can only imagine the other from somewhere, from your own base. So you know you're like this, and what are they like? And the real danger is if you think everybody's the same, then what you're actually doing is imposing what you are on them.
I have a question directed to either His or Her Excellency. How have schools in Canada gotten better since you were a kid?
How have schools gotten better since I was a kid?
Or how have they worsened?
I don't have to look around and see a whole bunch of people who look like me. It's a lot more fun.
When I hear of what activities you do here, I think that my school, even though we had much more, I think, very limited resources, Canada was a much poorer country 50 years ago when I started high school. People did not have cars. People did not buy records and go shopping as recreation. It just was a different kind of country. We used to have to, occasionally drive to Montreal from Ottawa to buy Chinese vegetables because there weren't any in Ottawa. And all of that to say that it was a much simpler place, and so therefore the school system in a way reflected it by its simplicity. But we still had clubs. We didn't have to pay for anything. And every school that I went to was a tremendously mixed school, especially my public schools, because there were only six in the downtown area. And the one I went to happened to be in a very more densely populated. It's now been torn down. Every school I went to has been torn down except for my high school, because the city has grown in the center of it. And I think we had dancing, we had music. We didn't have bands. They could not afford instruments in the 50s. I think just at the end of when I was leaving high school, a band started, and I think that was when they had a little more money. But there was no opportunity to learn an instrument when I was in high school. So I think from that material point of view, things are better. However, from the academic point of view, I had a terrific education. I had history from the ancient, you know, ancient history, modern history, Canadian geography, and that was all the history was one. We had a history course every year. We moved through civilization, Western granted, and then we also had very good science courses. We had our literature courses were excellent, and we read an enormous amount, and we were asked to do reports on it. And so I think from the point of view of content, I have the feeling, and I never like to talk about it too much because it makes you sound very fusty, that it was better, that we had very, very good textbooks, and we had wonderful teachers. So I don't think that's changed. I think there's still tremendous teachers, very committed. And that's what I always know is the teaching profession is a wonderful one because teachers give so much of themselves, not only their technical expertise, but so much of themselves in terms of their human qualities.
How does Canadian society treat refugees now compared to when your family came to Canada?
How does Canadian society treat refugees now? Well, they recognize that there is such a thing now. When I came, I think a lot of people were refugees without that name being attached to it. And now you're officially refugee because there's boards and there's people to look and examine the papers and do all of that. Was much less, there was no organization to do that then, and there was certainly no structural help in the society. And that's what makes me very hopeful about Canadian society, is that when we came during the war in 1942, my father luckily was able to find a little job in the Canadian government as a clerk in the Ministry of Trade and Commerce. And so we had a little apartment, and we were perfectly comfortable. And then my mother didn't know how to cook because she'd never done that in Hong Kong. And we came with one suitcase each. We lived in a neighborhood where we went to school right away. My brother did anyway. And he was taken up by a nice Jewish friend whose father was a pharmacist, and they helped us a great deal, Malotte's Pharmacy. And they were very kind to us. And there were some French-Canadian families around us who helped to teach my mother to cook. But they did that of their own because they saw, basically, that we needed some help, and they were very happy to give that. So I think that still exists, but at a much more structured and organized level. But the fundamental desire of people to help each other is still there.
Thank you. I'm a grade 10 Montessori student. And we are required to do a set amount of community service hours. How do you think this would or would not benefit Canadian students?
This is not the case for other students. There's no set hours?
There is, but it is a much smaller amount. So like a larger.
You know, there's no simple answer to this. I mean, what you want to do is get used to volunteering and being involved in your society. We call it volunteering now. It's really just being a citizen, getting out there and doing stuff. That isn't about you. And, you know, you never get 100% of the people doing it 50% of the time, which would be a good ideal. So there are going to be some leadership groups. But it works best if it really has purpose. And we were chatting with some people in Vancouver two nights ago about it, and they were saying the places where it works is when, for example, a group in the school goes out to the community and says, look, is there anything we can do for you? You tell us what you want us to do. Could we be helpful in some way? But you need that kind of leadership from the students or from the teachers or both, and then it works. I think just saying I guess even if all people are doing is photocopying for somebody, it's still something. You know, there are just thousands of ways you can volunteer. Some of it's very edgy, some of it's very ordinary, but at least it gets people out. Probably have to have a variety of ways of doing it for it to make any sense. Just get used to it. I always say, you know, well, you're, you know, students and reasonably poor, it's good to get used to doing things for nothing. Because later on, when you've made some money, you'll start thinking you can't afford to do it anymore. It's one of those ironies of life. So, and it isn't true, you can afford to do it, and this is a good time to get into the habit.
We often hear that the way of life here in Western Canada is different than that of Central and Eastern Canada. Can you comment on the different attitudes each region has towards education?
I'm not sure I can answer that. I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting about Canada is that it's because it's so large, there are real regional ways of life. There's no question. And that's a great thing about the country, and we shouldn't worry about that. The fact that we our ways of life and even our speeds and even the way in which we argue is quite different. And we're in all these communities, so we see it. We have to adjust into each community, which is fun for us. I'm not sure that it shows up that much in the education, though, frankly. Do you think it shows up in the education? I don't. See, I think underneath it all, what actually makes the country, what's different about this country is that most countries were very divided and spent a couple of hundred years basically with centralized governments grinding down the differences, banning languages, banning religions, banning the admission of racial differences and things. And you look at the European countries, even the United States with civil war and so on. And you know, one mythology. Whereas Canada never did that. We always were pretty relaxed about that, even when we had our flaws, because we always had at least the French and the English, and in the beginning the Aboriginal French and the English, and now we're coming back to that as well. So that what's held the country together isn't, as in France, everybody will stand up at 10 o'clock and recite the same poem across the country. What's held Canada together has actually been a sort of reasonable agreement about the ethics, the values, what do we stand for? Well, basically, the country doesn't believe in capital punishment. The country believes in public education. The country believes in single-tier health care. The country, you know, and so you sort of say, gosh, if you could get 20 things like that that everybody agreed on, then that is an education. That is a country. And that's much more important than having an agreement on what color or what language or what, the more superficial things, in a way. So I think there's a kind of unity in the education because of the agreement on the ethics.
Hi, my name is Jennifer, and I was wondering, as Governor General, what do you feel has been your greatest accomplishment?
I've been able to meet people like you and be in communities with people and go everywhere from Medicine Hat to Dryden, Ontario, to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, to Hopedale, Newfoundland, Labrador. Rankin Inlet, to all of those places, and see that we are the same people. I mean, it gives you tremendous confidence as a Canadian, because there's this stupid, insufferable thing about how do we know we're Canadian, etc. We know we are Canadian because of the things that John just mentioned. There are certain things that are belief, parts of our belief about ourselves. I think public education is the numero uno, always has been, and it will always be, as long as we decide we're going to take anywhere from 200 to 300,000 immigrants a year. There is no way in which you can become a Canadian without public school education. And it has to be public school education so that kids like you are in contact with everybody all the time who are of different, not only different racial backgrounds and religious ones, but also of different incomes. That was the big benefit to me of going to a school where basically there were so many different, even in that time, there were very different groups of people. There were Jews, there were a lot of Lebanese in Ottawa, there was the old sort of Scottish, Irish, there was very few Chinese, I only knew another one who was in my high school. Canada was a different place. But I think that that's, whatever is an accomplishment will be judged by others.
Thank you. This question is for Her Excellency. I'm just wondering, how does it feel to be the second woman Governor General of Canada?
The woman thing is very, very interesting, because I am, there was the first great wave of feminism when women got the vote and struggled and eventually got the vote just about the time of the First World War. Then they were officially recognized as persons in 1928, and because they were not considered to be persons, they couldn't be in the Senate. Then that battle was won, and in fact, in a month from now, I'll be giving the Persons Award to five remarkable women in Canada for what they've contributed. And I think that women are... to be the second woman Governor General and the first immigrant, I think those things go together. The first woman Governor General couldn't have been more Canadian. Jeanne Sauvé was a marvelous woman who'd had a very good, terrific career as a politician, as a broadcaster, and she had been born as a French Canadian in a small town in Saskatchewan. So that was really, really Canadian. So she was the first Canadian, woman governor general, and I think that was very fitting. I think that what I've brought to it is that I think that people can look at me as a woman and as an immigrant and think that that's possible for them. And even if they don't want to become governor general or want to be, that it opens up avenues of possibility. When I was growing up, I would never have dreamed, I mean, I could have dreamed of being a prima ballerina or a great doctor, but I could never have dreamed of being a governor general because they were all old white men. And if you don't have the role model at all, then you know, you don't even think about it.
Interesting old white men.
Some. But I think that I'm very, very happy when people think that I help them have, they say, role model or whatever way they want to put it. Sometimes it's just put that basically. And I'm happy about that. I think that I feel that that's a responsibility to Canadian society that I have fulfilled. And I think that as a woman, I have also been a pioneer in many ways through the years that I was in television and the kind of programs that I did and started. And I think that being Governor General has really just, you know, tied that up.
Thank you.
Oh, one thing I'm reminded here, as a first woman immigrant, Anglophone, bilingual. And it's interesting, that is very interesting, because when I was at university in the late 50s and graduating in 1960, I decided that I would like to go, after I had studied on for another year or two to do an MA, that I really wanted to go to France to learn French. And that was not a thing that many people did then. I only had two other friends who wanted to go to France and learn French. The others all went to the United States to do graduate work, or went to Britain to do graduate work in universities. And nobody thought that it was really that. They thought it might be kind of nice to speak French, sort of. We had some exchanges with the University of Montreal as undergraduates. But they didn't really think that it was going to be that vital or important. And that kind of instinctive decision that I made then, and that my parents really approved of, and thought was terrific, has stood me in great stead, and I'm very proud of it.
Thank you.